Iran's foreign minister says people in the West Asia region will never accept normalization of their country's relations with, quote, the terrorist and child-killing Israeli regime. Palestinians gathered in occupied territories to pay tribute to a journalist fatally shot by Israeli forces in the West Bank city of Jenin. Arab member states of the UN and the UN rights chief have condemned Israel's killing of Palestinian journalists, calling for an international probe into the incident. Hello everyone, very warm welcome to World News. In our top story, Iran's foreign minister says people in the West Asia region will never accept normalization of their country's ties with, quote, terrorists and child-killing Israeli regime. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a meeting with the visiting Lebanese culture minister, Mohammad Wissam al-Murtada, in Tehran. The top Iranian diplomat added the resistance of the Lebanese people in the face of Israel's frequent acts of aggression is a brilliant model for other regional nations. He said Tehran is ready to boost economic cooperation with Beirut despite cruel Western sanctions. Al-Murtada, for his part, said Lebanon is prepared to expand relations with all friendly nations in the region, especially Iran. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it's destroyed the positions of terrorist groups operating in Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. IRGC's ground forces reportedly targeted the terrorist hideouts in the city of Erbil with artillery fire. There has been no reports of casualties or damage from the attack yet, but the operation follows the arrest of a terrorist squad planning to carry out acts of sabotage in western Iran. A statement says confessions made by the detainees led to the operation on Wednesday morning. Iran has time and again warned Iraq's Kurdistan region that it reserves the right to hit terrorist groups operating in its area. In September last year, Iranian missiles destroyed four bases of hostile groups, and in March of this year, the IRGC fired a dozen ballistic missiles at what it described as a secret base of the Israeli spy agency Mossad in Erbil. EU coordinator for the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA has held talks with Iran's chief negotiator. Meeting between Enrique Mora and Ali Bagheri Kani was held in a bid to try to give new impetus to try to save the 2015 deal. Talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the pact have stalled since mid-March. Mora has played a key role as intermediary between the U.S. and Iran during a year of talks in Vienna to try to restore the deal. Prior to his visit, Mora wrote or tweeted that he's coming to Tehran to work on closing remaining gaps in the talks. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said on Monday that Mora's visit shows the talks are still moving forward, but said that this doesn't mean that he will arrive with a new message. Israeli forces have killed a reporter working for the Qatar-based Al Jazeera TV network in the occupied West Bank. Shireen Abu Akleh was fatally shot covering an Israeli army raid in the city of Jenin, and she was a veteran Palestinian reporter for Al Jazeera's Arab language channel. Palestinians have gathered in the city of Ramallah to pay respects to her. Israeli officials say Palestinians may be responsible for the death of the 51-year-old journalist, but another reporter that was with Abu Akleh, who was also shot in the back, has called the Israeli claim an outright lie.
Palestinian reporter Shireen Abu Akleh was shot while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The veteran reporter who worked for Al Jazeera's Arab language channel was shot in the face by Israeli forces despite wearing a blue flak jacket clearly marked with press. Israeli officials claim Palestinians may be responsible for the death of the 51-year-old journalist. But another reporter accompanying Abu Akleh, who was also shot in the back, rejected the Israeli claim as a lie.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shireen and caused her death. There were no armed people and we cannot put our lives in danger and say the wrong narrative. The Israeli army is a liar and criminal and despicable.
Al Jazeera also said Abu Akleh was assassinated in cold blood and urged the international community to hold Israeli forces responsible. The Palestinian Authority said Abu Akleh's killing is a heinous crime and part of the occupation's policy of targeting journalists to obscure the truth and commit crimes silently. In Gaza, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas described the killing as a new crime against journalism in Palestine, while the Islamic Jihad movement branded it an unsuccessful attempt to cover up realities. The journalist's murder also drew widespread condemnation from countries across the world, such as Iran, Pakistan, and Belgium. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh called Abu Akleh's killing a deliberate and criminal act. The United Nations called for an immediate and thorough investigation and for those responsible to be held accountable, a request that was echoed by the European Union.
We immediately called for a swift and independent investigation so that the perpetrators of this terrible crime can be brought to justice.
The International Federation of Journalists said it would submit Abu Akleh's case to the International Criminal Court. Abu Akleh's murder is just the tip of the iceberg of crimes committed by Israel against journalists. Reporters Without Borders say nearly 150 Palestinian journalists have been wounded by Israeli forces across the Gaza Strip and the West Bank since 2018. Israeli strikes also destroyed a building housing local offices of media outlets during its last year's war on Gaza. Such atrocity, along with frequent raids and shootings in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, show that the Israeli regime has no scruples about murdering unarmed Palestinians. The silence of the international community is also seen as a green light for Israel to continue such crimes.
Journalist and political commentator Richard Medhurst joined us earlier with his take on the Israeli killing of Palestinian journalists that worked for Al Jazeera.
When we're talking about Shireen Abu Akleh, she is like a household name. Everyone has grown up watching her on television covering the Palestinian issue and exposing the Israeli occupation for what it is. And like you said, she's without a doubt on their radar. The thing is that, you know, people have become desensitized to violence against Arabs and violence against Palestinians, that this is going to go unpunished and unsanctioned and so on, right? If this was a Ukrainian female journalist that was killed by the Russians, it would be front page news. But if you go and you look at the New York Times, you look at CBS, they don't say that Israel shot Shireen dead. They say that she was fatally shot during clashes. There were no clashes. We have all seen the videos. She was wearing her press patch, the helmet. So were the other journalists with her, her colleagues from various other outlets, and they were fired upon intentionally. This bullet hit her right here in the exposed part and blew her face off. It is absolutely heartbreaking and revolting. And this is really, again, emblematic of what the Israeli occupation is and how they treat Palestinians and journalists. And we remember last year they bombed in Gaza the press buildings of Al Jazeera and the Associated Press, and they got away with it, and no one cares. And this is, again, a continuation of that. And the fact that this happened to Shireen, I mean, this is really, it would be heartbreaking regardless, because every day we're seeing Palestinians being brutalized and killed like this. But for someone that everybody knows, who has, they've grown up watching on their TV screens, it is really tragic.
Now, Palestine's UN envoy says Arab countries at the United Nations have called for an independent international probe into Israel's killing of Shireen Abu Akleh.
The Arab group in New York adopted a statement condemning in the strongest possible term this criminal act by the Israeli occupying authorities and demanding an international independent investigation on this crime and to take those who are responsible for this crime to face their, you know, the accountability regarding these crimes. Of course, you know, my
colleague Riyad Mansour said a demand for the probe into the assassination of the journalist was sent in identical letters to the UN chief, Antonio Guterres, the Security Council, and the General Assembly's president. Meanwhile, the office of the UN Human Rights Chief, Michelle Bachelet, also called for an independent and transparent investigation as well. Bachelet's office said it is appalled at the killing of the journalist. Meanwhile, there is no end in sight to Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. Regime forces have killed another Palestinian in occupied Al-Quds. Israeli forces opened fire at the Palestinian near Al-Aqsa Mosque. Regime claims that he was hit after he tried to attempt to stab an Israeli officer. And the regime's forces also shot dead three Palestinian youths in three separate attacks in the occupied West Bank on Sunday. Israel has intensified its crackdown on Palestinians. Recently, it's repeatedly stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque and attacked Palestinian worshippers. A new report shows more than 500 Native American children have died in U.S. government-run boarding schools over a period of more than a century. The Department of Interior's report says indigenous children were exposed to physical abuse, food denial, and other forms of punishment in state-run boarding schools. It says the school system pursued twin goals of cultural assimilation and territorial dispossession of indigenous peoples through relocation of their children. A study identified more than 400 such schools operating in the U.S. for over 150 years, starting back in the early 19th century. There are also more than 50 marked or unmarked burial sites. Deaths of 500 indigenous students have been attributed to just 19 schools that have so far been investigated. The department says that further probes may increase the number of student deaths to the thousands or even tens of thousands. The European Commission has proposed to establish a new EU agency to tackle the growing problem of child sex abuse in the 27-nation bloc. Unveiling the plans, the Commission says reports of such abuse in the EU have increased by 6,000% during the past decade. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Many believe the crime of sexually abusing a child is even more heinous than murder. The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, says 85 million child sex abuse videos and images were identified by the bloc's authorities last year, a record number.
In the EU, the reports related to the European Union the member states have increased with 6,000% the last 10 years. Why is this increasing? Of course, nobody knows for sure.
The Commission says it's not known exactly why these crimes are on the rise, but analysts say the EU has been allowed to expand too quickly, with some nations harbouring criminal gangs.
And now, of course, thanks to or due to open borders, are these criminal networks, they started to flourish and integrate further.
The EU Commission is proposing to establish a new agency designed to prevent child sex abuse and support victims.
At least one in five children falls victim to sexual violence during childhood in Europe. So these numbers are really embarrassing.
Anti-trafficking agencies say 2 million children recently entered the EU having fled the conflict in Ukraine, many of them unaccompanied. Gangs and individuals see an opportunity for exploitation.
The police and child protection services need to work together, plus they need to work together across borders, and there need to be better information sharing platforms.
The European Commission has a message for predators.
We are coming for you.
But critics are asking why more has not been done up to now. Given that it promotes itself as a project designed to protect and improve the lives of citizens, rights groups say this issue seriously undermines the credibility of the European Union. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Russia's foreign intelligence chief has accused Washington of spreading Nazi-style propaganda against Moscow. Sergei Naryshkin said the U.S. encourages the spreading of fake information on popular Telegram messaging service. He said the U.S. is seeking to discredit and dehumanize Russia's political and military leadership in the eyes of the Russian people. Naryshkin also compared the U.S. State Department to the infamous Nazi propaganda machine run by Joseph Goebbels. The U.S. State Department rejected the Russian officials, what they said, incredibly ironic statements. The department accused Moscow of long-standing state-sponsored disinformation and propaganda efforts. A new poll shows an average French person's life is being drastically impacted by runaway inflation. Coming after years of far-right economic austerity, the French economy now appears on the brink of major trouble. Rami Mazahari has your story from Paris.
France is a nation of 67 million people, and 40 million of them earn less than 2,000 euros per month. A new poll reveals that skyrocketing inflation is wreaking unprecedented havoc on their lives. The poll says that after bills are paid, 20 million Frenchmen have less than 100 euros in the bank by the 10th of each month. It's not a new problem. Perhaps the primary slogan of the Yellow Vest movement has been a cry of the end of the month.
For us delivery drivers, the price of gas has put us in a very difficult condition. I spent almost 60% more on petrol than I used to, and every day now. Of course, it's not just petrol. Everything else has gotten more expensive too. The state has to lower taxes.
A stunning 95% of those earning less than 2,000 euros per month are worried about inflation. Two-thirds say they are struggling to get by. Half say they have insomnia over financial worries. And 80% of households with children fear they will fall into poverty.
Everything is more expensive, and all my friends and I talk about it. Even the cost of something basic, like cooking oil, has gotten dramatically more expensive. We hope things will somehow get better, but for now, things are quite tight.
New official data says prices will jump 5.4% in June, in the largest monthly increase since 1985. The next 2 months will also see further increases, and combined with near-recession levels of economic growth. After years of no-strings-attached quantitative easing and zero interest rate policies for the rich, interest rates are now being hiked just when the average person most needs some credit. The failure to invest years of this so-called free money into societally productive investments means the real economy has suffered from long-running neglect at the expense of high finance, real estate, and stocks. Deeply unpopular austerity cuts have also worsened the condition of the real economy, put even more costs on the average person's back, and left France poorly equipped for what seems like the latest Western financial crisis. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
If the U.S. were genuinely interested in some sort of political solution to the Israeli apartheid practices regarding the Palestinians, nothing would be easier than to just step aside and let the world punish Bennett for his brutal policies, which amount to war crimes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Juan Cole, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. Double Standard on Display in Tepid Response to Israeli Regime's Theft of Palestinian Land. Stay tuned for more. The deputy spokesperson for the U.S. State Department, Yelena Porter, recently condemned the Zionist regime's announcement that it would build 4,000 further housing units in the Palestinian West Bank. That is, it would steal land owned by Palestinian families and bring in squatters from the Zionist regime to squat on that land. The full lack of seriousness in the U.S. regime on this issue is obvious. The Zionist regime maintains that the Palestinian West Bank belongs to it, even though no such baseless claim is recognized in international law. The Israeli newspaper Arab 48 reports that the Israeli civil administration of the occupied Palestinian West Bank will decide on 3,988 new housing units for Zionist squatters on Palestinian land next month. This additional building of housing infrastructure on Palestinian land will ultimately further displace and impoverish Palestinians, the rightful inhabitants of the land, Palestine. The fake regime of Israel can behave this way, in brazen violation of the international law governing how occupying powers treat the people they occupy during wartime, only because the U.S. regime runs interference for Israeli regime in international bodies. Otherwise, the world would put sanctions on the fabricated regime of Israel for invading and occupying and trying to annex Palestinian land. Separately, we understand that the Zionist regime announced a meeting to advance new West Bank settlements for West Bank settlement units for May 12th. The Biden administration has been clear from the outset. We strongly oppose the expansion of settlements, which exacerbates tensions and undermines trust between parties. The Zionist regime program of expanding settlements deeply damages the prospect for a two-state solution. So then, Ron Campis, the Washington, D.C. bureau chief of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, asked what the repercussions will be for the Zionist regime in going ahead with the new housing settlements. He wanted to know how it would affect President Biden's planned trip to the occupied territories in June. Hint, there are no repercussions. Ms. Porter replied, as one might expect with platitudes so excruciatingly mind-numbing that no one else would want to raise the question again for at least a century. I will just say from here that we have been clear about the need to avoid unilateral steps that would exacerbate tensions and make it more difficult to preserve the viability of a two-state solution. I have nothing to comment about the president's upcoming trip, unquote. There is no viable two-state solution. The fabricated regime of Israel has plunked down so many hundreds of thousands of squatters in Palestinian population centers that the territory looks like Swiss cheese on a map.
It is just something American politicians say to kick the can down the road while the Israelis grab more and more of the West Bank. It is sort of like telling a team of bank robbers in the midst of a haste that you really regret their unfortunate actions and urge them not to damage the liquidity of the bank beyond the point where both the robbers and the bank owners can coexist. If the U.S. were genuinely interested in some sort of political solution to the Israeli apartheid practices regarding the Palestinians, nothing would be easier than to just step aside and let the world punish Bennett for the brutal policies, which amount to war crimes. Washington wouldn't even have to be proactive itself. The Zionist regime prime minister, Naftali Bennett, made $200 million with software and would feel the pain if he were sanctioned. But official Washington is so in the tank for Israeli apartheid that making such a suggestion sounds outlandish.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. As always, it's my pleasure and absolute honor to be joined by my special guest and darling sister, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, my dear Sister Zainab.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Really
absolute
honored.
Pleasure. So we've been discussing the topic of cohabitation and its pros and cons, especially in comparison with an official binding marriage. Well, obviously, there are pros and cons to marriage also. But if we're looking at it from an Islamic perspective, cohabitation is not even a possibility for a man and a woman. I mean, if you're going to live together, go ahead and get married. If you're not married, you have no business living together.
Based on contract and Islamic rules and Sharia, there is no place. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the reality of societies, this has become a trend. This has become a very popular issue. Boys and girls are no longer willing to undergo the commitment of marriage. And they just say, it's so much easier. It's so much more convenient. Why should I get married?
Now, the question that comes to mind is that, well, what happened? What happened that in a society where not only does the culture promote, dictate, really, I mean, oh my God, can you imagine anything else other than this?
Marriage?
Yeah.
I can imagine easily.
From an Islamic family, no.
If it's real Islam, yes, what you're saying is true.
I mean, my parents aren't scholars and mystics, but can you imagine their daughter or their sons cohabiting with a random person from the opposite gender? No.
So what I'm trying to
understand here is that what sort of phenomenon occurred in the world that led to the younger people choosing cohabitation over quote unquote marriage?
Uh-huh.
While the life arrangements are almost the same. Like, I can't give you exact numbers, but even in countries where, even in certain Eastern or Asian, let's say, non-Islamic countries, India, supposedly, or the more conservative...
Even in the Western world up until 2 decades ago, this was a taboo.
Japan.
Even in America. Even in Canada, the phenomenon of cohabitation was a taboo for people. Nobody, even if, you know, like, this wasn't the norm in the society. You either, you know, married or you were not married, right? Mm. But it's becoming so prevalent.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Muslim Lady here on IRIB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break. Stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. This is Muslim Lady. And in the studio today, we've been talking about the hot topic of cohabitation.
I think my own understanding, because as I was reading the articles, it was saying that 3 in 10 cohabiting adults who are not engaged but say that they would like to get married someday say that their partner or their own lack of financial readiness. Lack of financial readiness.
I think that's the trouble in a lot of Islamic countries as well.
Also, roughly 4 in 10 cite not being far enough along in their job.
Yeah.
So, you see, remember that we used to talk about the topic of capitalism, humanism, modernism, remember?
For
the
sure.
values in that system that that were dictated to people were that you had to continue your education. So equal, you know, this fight for equal educational position for boys and girls, that was the first fight. After that, then you're a graduate, you have educated, then you want an equal job opportunity. Then what I'm trying to say is that more money, more social prestige and social class and power, these are the criterions that define your value in a modern society. So things like spirituality, protecting half of my religion, these are non-existent. These are like jokes.
True.
Right? So the reason why anywhere in the world, East and the West, cohabitation has become a trendy phenomenon is that people care about material standards of life. Their job is a definition of their success. Their income, the number of zeros in front of their income, defines how successful they are in this world, right? So, and then it's very interesting, Zainab, that in this mentality, 2 plus 2 is 4. If I have to have a schedule, a long-term and a short-term plan, in the first 3 years of my life, I'm going to achieve these goals. In the second 6 years, this. In the second 4 years, this. So everything comes down to my own calculations, that 2 plus 2 is 4. Whereas in the Islamic point of view, there's this beautiful ayah that says that if you're scared of getting married for financial reasons, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will grant you. It's a beautiful ayah. I think that ayah is in the verse that says, it tells people to marry off the singles in their society. Wankihul ayama minkum. Let me look it up because it's a very beautiful verse.
The reason behind the gravitation, the inclination a lot of our youth have toward cohabitation rather than official marriage is because of the huge hoopla that's been made out of marriage and all the steps and all the annoying complications, that complicated, tedious, tiring process that they have to go through in order to get married. The ceremony and the back and forth and all that cultural nonsense and inviting strangers
totally
that you've
true.
Never met before in your life, but you've gotta because your parents say to you, well, what will other people say? And all of that, and I feel like the new generation just can't be bothered with it. One of the very interesting concepts that exists within Islam, which really has won me over when I was converting to Islam, is that marriage should be done simply. No, the simpler, the better.
Very true.
Right.
I was actually watching one of those humorous clips. By the way, I found the verse. Mm-hmm. It's in Surah Nur, chapter 24, verse number 32. وَنْكِهُ الْأَيَامَ مِنْكُمْ وَالصَّالِحِينَ مِنْ عِبَادِكُمْ وَإِمَائِكُمْ إِنْ يَكُونُوا فُغَرَاءَ يُغْنِهِمُ اللَّهُ مِنْ فَضْلِهِ وَاللَّهُ وَاسِعٌ عَلِيمٌ. Which means that married off those who are single among you and the upright among your male and female slaves, if they are poor... The two reasons, lack of financial readiness, not being far enough along in their job. If they are poor, Allah will enrich them out of His grace. SubhanAllah. So it's, you know, Zainab, it's 2 + 2 = 200.
Yeah, true.
2 + 2 = 2,000, 2 million.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, I was watching this clip yesterday, and this lady was saying that back then in Iran, when you wanted to get married, there were no halls, wedding halls. Mm-hmm. It was your house and your neighbor's house. And you invited 50, 60 people, women, and 50, 60 men, and you made the kebab, and only one drink, one beverage, no salad, no yogurt, mm-hmm. no jellies, no pudding, yeah. no this, no that. That's it. Right? But these days, like, you have to spend millions and, you know, thousands of dollars on, you know, having a very beautiful, fancy, elegant. It's as if you're like a princess, you know, very luxurious, very.
The financial toll of weddings and marriage, not being married, the process of getting married is so much. Mm-hmm. The financial, the emotional, and the psychological toll of it all is so much that the younger generation just can't be bothered with it anymore. And you know, to an extent, I'm
if
not saying
that... they're going to be more...
If it was made more simple less people stuck their nose into their business, mm-hmm. I don't think the younger generation would necessarily have a problem
with
it.
What do you mean, put their nose less in their business? How do other people intervene in young couples' businesses?
How do they not intervene in young
couples'
lives?
Wouldn't they intervene if you're cohabiting?
I really have never come across a Muslim, to be perfectly honest, a Muslim...
Cohabiting?
Yeah, Muslim cohabitation. Even in my circle of friends or families, those who cohabit are married.
Why wouldn't this couple, mm-hmm. that they're having a temporary relationship, why wouldn't they get married?
Because they don't find themselves compatible in long term.
Uh-huh.
And that's a valid reason. We're okay for each other now. If she didn't have any other choices, then that was the best alternative for the time. A temporary solution to a temporary problem through temporary marriage.
We were talking about the fact that this couple who decided to undergo mut'ah, mm-hmm. for the time being, because this was the best choice they could possibly make. I'm just saying, if the society moves towards practicing Islam in the real sense.
Okay, what's the more Islamic alternative?
The more Islamic alternative
ideal
is that...
Ideal Islamic alternative.
Look at the time of the Prophet.
Sallallahu alayhi
wa sallam. When a woman... Her husband died in a war, or he died for any reason. And then she got married to men. Okay, to a married man.
I mean, a man her age range is married.
Okay,
a man younger than her usually does not want to raise another man's kids, wants to have children of her own.
But nowadays, because of the high percentage of divorces in societies, Islamic and non-Islamic, there are a lot of single guys in her age range, because they don't want to go under the commitment of marriage, his temporary wife, mm-hmm. right? A lot of this problem for women will be solved if they go under the umbrella of a married man's life, family, where based on today's norms and acceptance of families.
It got me thinking that, well, obviously no one was held at gunpoint to walk into such an arrangement, right? They all got into it out of their own free will because it seemed like the only plausible solution for their needs to be met. And they did not sin. They did it in the utmost shara'i way.
We should draw a line here between cohabitation and temporary marriage. Because in Islam, there are certain regulations and shari'i rulings with regards to your temporary marriage. Mm-hmm. You have to have iddah. There are some rulings in terms of inheritance, in terms of the child, inheritance of the child that is you know, the result of this marriage. The custody.
Cohabitation is a very unstable arrangement. It lacks security. It lacks trust. It lacks protection, right? That was interesting, and that was all the time that we have for today's episode. Thank you so very much for joining us. Until another salam, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you.
in the limelight.
In the United States, the white net being cast by Justice Department prosecutors as they move beyond charging 6th of January rioters could encompass scores of potential witnesses from both inside and outside of government. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer, Luke Broadwater and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled Justice Department Investigation of 6th of January Confronts Sprawling Cast of Characters. Among the challenges facing the federal grand jury recently empaneled to investigate the 6th of January attack on the Capitol is the sheer number of people who might have information relevant to its inquiry. According to a subpoena issued by the grand jury, prosecutors are asking for records about people who organized or spoke at several pro-Trump rallies after the election. They presumably include two events in Washington in November and December of 2020, that preceded the gathering on the Ellipse near the White House on 6th of January 2021, where President Donald J. Trump told the crowd to descend on the Capitol. The subpoena is also seeking records about anyone who provided security at those events, and about those who were deemed to be VIP attendees. Moreover, it requests information about any members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who may have taken part in planning or executing the rallies, or tried to obstruct, influence, impede, or delay the certification of the presidential election. Each of these broad categories could involve dozens of individuals. Taken together, the total number of potential witnesses, or at some point targets, sought after by the grand jury could easily reach into the hundreds. The investigation appears to be in its early stages, and there is no way of knowing at this point where it may go, what crimes it might identify, or who it may ultimately focus on. Many people of interest to investigators might be called only as witnesses. One possible roadmap, at least in terms of who the grand jury may still want to hear from, is the parallel probe by the House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack, which has already interviewed hundreds of witnesses, including on Tuesday, 5th of April, Ivanka Trump, the former president's daughter and advisor. A relatively small group of political operatives did the bulk of the work in organizing the pro-Trump rallies in Washington that kicked off after the election and sought to challenge the results, often using the slogan, Stop the Steal. Prominent among them, according to interviews and documents, was Amy Kramer, a former Tea Party activist who helped create a group called Women for America First. The group set up a cross-country bus tour gathering Mr. Trump's aggrieved supporters behind the baseless assertions of a stolen election. Within hours of the last polls closing on Election Day, Amy Kramer started working closely with her daughter, Kylie Jane Kramer, to set up one of the first Stop the Steal Facebook pages. Both women were involved, often in close coordination with the White House, in planning pro-Trump rallies on 14th of November and 12th of December 2020, and then in setting up Donald Trump's appearance at the Ellipse on 6th of January 2021. Two other people who helped Amy Kramer were Jennifer Lawrence and Dustin Stockton, both of whom had once worked closely with Steve Bannon, a former top advisor to Donald Trump. Another organizer for Women for America First was Cindy Shafian, who ultimately broke away from the group to form a new organization, the 80% Coalition, which planned its own event on 5th of January 2021. Then there was a separate group of planners around Ali Alexander, a provocateur who rose in right-wing circles after the election. Mr. Alexander, an associate of Donald Trump's longtime advisor, Roger Stone, was part of a group of activists who planned an event at the Capitol itself and marched with the crowd to the building after Donald Trump's speech at the Ellipse. Altogether, scores of people spoke at the rallies in November and December and at the gathering on 5th of January and 6th of January. They included people like Mr. Stone, Donald Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist and host of the television show InfoWars. The speakers also included pastors, state-level politicians, and anti-vaccine activists. It is hard to know who prosecutors might consider a VIP from these events, especially for the November rally, often known as the Million MAGA March, and the one in December, which is sometimes referred to as the Jericho March. There were dozens of VIPs who attended Donald Trump's incendiary speech at the Ellipse on 6th of January 2021, according to leaked documents from event organizers. That rally also featured appearances by Rudolph Giuliani, Donald Trump's personal lawyer, and John Eastman, the law professor who was promoting the idea that Vice President Mike Pence could block congressional certification of the Electoral College results. The attendees at the Ellipse speech included Mike Lindell, the MyPillow chief executive who helped spread Donald Trump's lies about a rigged election, and the YouTube stars known as Diamond and Silk, who are prominent Donald Trump supporters. The federal grand jury subpoena examined by the New York Times seeks information about members of the executive and legislative branches of the government who might have been involved in the effort to delay congressional certification of the election results, suggesting that prosecutors are interested in learning more about the roles that Donald Trump's aides and allies inside the government may have played. It is not clear if any Trump-era executive or legislative branch members have received subpoenas, and there is no public indication that anyone has been targeted for prosecution. But in looking for more information about what was happening at both the White House and on Capitol Hill as Donald Trump sought to stay in power, the House Select Committee has already expressed interest in a range of White House and campaign advisors, as well as contractors who work to set up the rally. They exist in concentric circles in and around Donald Trump's orbit. Among them is Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff under Donald Trump, who turned over text messages to the House Select Committee that served as a roadmap not just for his own activities, but those of others. He was one of the few people with Donald Trump as the riot at the Capitol took place. Katrina Pearson, a longtime Trump political advisor, was in direct contact with Donald Trump about the details of the rallies on 5th of January and 6th of January 2021, including who would be speaking and what music will be played, according to a former administration official and a House committee. Katrina Pearson attended a meeting in which Donald Trump is said to have discussed wanting the National Guard deployed, anticipating counter-protests. Caroline Wren, a professional fundraiser and a friend of Kimberly Guilfoyle, an advisor to Donald Trump and a girlfriend of Donald Trump Jr., was listed on an attachment for a permit that rally organizers gave the Park Police. Megan Powers, a longtime Donald Trump aide, was listed on a rally permit. Among the Republicans in Congress who worked publicly to keep Donald Trump in power where Representatives Mo Brooks of Alabama, Paul Gosar of Arizona, and Andy Biggs of Arizona, all of whom Ali Alexander, the Stop the Steal organizer, has said helped set the events of 6th of January in motion. We four schemed up of putting maximum pressure on Congress while they were voting, Ali Alexander said in a since-deleted video posted online, so that who we couldn't lobby, we could change the hearts and the minds of Republicans who were in that body, hearing our loud roar from outside. Paul Gosar's chief of staff has said his office merely promoted Stop the Steal events and was not involved in planning them. Mr. Biggs, who provided a video message for Ali Alexander to play at a 19th of December rally, has denied coordinating event planning with Mr. Alexander. Mo Brooks, who wore body armor on stage on 6th of January 2021 as he told the crowd to start taking down names, also denied coordinating with Mr. Alexander. Mo Brooks recently turned on Donald Trump after the former president rescinded his endorsement in a Senate race and said Donald Trump had repeatedly asked him in recent months to illegally rescind the election, remove President Biden, and force a new special election. Mr. Brooks was one of two members of Congress who spoke at Donald Trump's rally at the Ellipse before the attack on the Capitol. The other was Representative Madison Cawthorn, Republican of North Carolina, who weeks earlier encouraged the public to call members of Congress and lightly threatened them if they did not support Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud. Representative Louie Gohmert, Republican of Texas, unsuccessfully sued Mike Pence over his refusal to interfere in the election certification. Other Republicans who used inflammatory rhetoric around that time included Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Lauren Boebert of Colorado, first-term lawmakers who referred to the day as Republicans' 1776 moment. On 21st of December 2020, Donald Trump met with members of the House Freedom Caucus to discuss their plans to challenge Joe Biden's victory. Among those present were Paul Gosar, Mr. Biggs, Mo Brooks, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and Representatives Jim Jordan of Ohio and Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, who were deeply involved in Mr. Trump's efforts to fight the election results. The House Committee has so far asked only three members of Congress for an interview: Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the Republican leader who engaged in what he called a very heated call with Donald Trump during the riot; Jim Jordan; and Scott Perry. All three men have refused to agree to a voluntary interview.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.